Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hi everyone, I'm Yash, your host for the New Books Network. Today we will talk to Dr. Reena Verma Williams about a new book, Marginalized, Mobilized, Incorporated, Women and Religious Nationalism in Indian Democracy, which was published by the Oxford University Press in 2023. Thank you so much for joining me today for this conversation.
Thank you for having me.
So starting with the first question, could you share the intellectual journey that led you to become interested in the study of gender and Hindu nationalist politics in India?
Yes. So the idea for this book grew directly out of my first book called Postcolonial Politics and Personal Laws, which was also the revision and publication of my PhD dissertation. And that book considered the history of the religious personal laws in India, their system of religious family laws, and how that legal system had affected women and different communities. The final chapter of the book examined how those laws had changed under the BJP's first stint in government from 1999 until 2004. And it was in the process of writing and researching that chapter that the question emerged in my mind. Here was a religious nationalist political party in a democracy that needed to win the votes of women. But how did they negotiate this electoral need with an ideology that was not necessarily the most gender progressive? And it was my desire to understand that question that led to this book.
Thank you. That's fairly enlightening and gives us a good setup to get into the book now. Mm-hmm. So in the introduction to the book, you have three questions that neatly guide the reader through some of the underlying questions which are about the book's subject as such. And these questions are: why women, why political parties, and why India? Could you give the audience a brief overview of why you focus on these questions and how you answer them in the book?
Yes, absolutely. So I consider these the three foci, and in some ways, the three puzzles that drive the underlying question of the book. So building on my previous response, it's clear that the questions of how a political party of a particular type mobilizes women as voters in a democracy, those questions constitute two of these three underlying puzzles. And then the third, the question of why India, drives my argument that India, with its religiously diverse society and democratic political system, becomes the perfect context in which to unravel these other questions. I consider political parties unique amongst different kinds of organizations because they have to appeal to voters. And gender and studying women is a lens for me through which, in this book, to understand how they mobilize voters that might not otherwise be their natural base. And in terms of the question of why India, as I put it in the book, and here I quote, India is a critical case to study religious nationalist politics in a global South democracy. As two of the most salient forces of modern political life, democracy and religion must find ways to coexist, and both exist in abundance in India. So that's how I sort of came to those three questions.
Great, thank you. Now, in the book, you highlight a key ideological tension within the Hindu nationalist framework between what you call the BJP's, quote, ideological roots in religion and nationalism, which tend to confine women to the private sphere. And on the other hand, its need as a political party to involve and engage women in the political sphere in order to win elections, unquote. How do you think the movement has navigated this tension?
So here you have, of course, identified the core question of the book itself. The answer, I find, in short, is that the political parties of Hindu nationalism have navigated this tension differently in different time periods. The parties I focus on are the Hindu Mahasabha in the early 20th century and the BJP from 1980 onwards. In its shortest version, my argument is that the Mahasabha never did manage to navigate the tension. It just suppressed or succumbed to it. And that is the tension between an ideology and a need to mobilize women as voters. So they kind of never dealt with it. They did not navigate the tension. Then starting in 1980, the BJP managed the tension by mobilizing women. This effectively meant bringing women into the streets in support of the party's causes and agendas, but without necessarily giving them a place of genuine power within the party's structures. And then finally, in the period since the 2014 elections, when the BJP returned to power at the center after a decade in the opposition, by this time the party had found a way to incorporate women. So they moved away from mobilization, not abandoned mobilization, but a primary mode becomes what I call incorporation. And I define this as bringing women into positions of power within the party and giving them voice to speak for the party's causes and agendas. But I stopped short of calling this phase inclusion of women. Here I'm making air quotes, inclusion of women, because I didn't find evidence of what I would consider full inclusion in a sense. Rather, I found that even as women have been incorporated into the party, the gender ideologies of the party and of party leaders, including men and women alike, so those gender ideologies of Hindu nationalism do continue to tether women conceptually to their roles in the whole home and family. And so ultimately, I argue that the incorporation of women has benefited the BJP as a party more than it has benefited women per se.
And we'll get into each of those, I think, in slightly more detail, as well as the gender ideology of Hindu nationalists. But before that, in chapter two, which is titled Mobilized Women, you engage with the idea of Hindu nationalist political participation as potentially empowering for women. And here you claim in the book that you conceptualize empowerment as a continuous rather than a dichotomous concept. Could you explain that for the audience?
Yes, absolutely. So I mean to try to argue that empowerment of or for women is not a yes, no kind of concept. It's not that women either are empowered or they aren't. Rather, I want to argue that women can be more or less empowered and that empowerment can look different ways for different women at different times. It could be complicated. It's not just a yes or no answer. So I don't and didn't find it useful to try to answer the question of whether women's participation in Hindu nationalist politics is or has been or can be empowering for women or not. That, again, is a yes, no type of question. And it's you know, a question that I and other scholars I have identified in this book and other scholars have also talked about being one of sort of the classic or traditional, right, very oft considered questions about women's participation in Hindu nationalist politics. Is it empowering? Could it be empowering? So I'm trying to move away from that idea of empowerment as just a yes, no concept. Either women are or they aren't. I feel that that kind of question, can it be empowering or not, neglects, has the potential of neglecting the nuances of what women and which women themselves think or feel empowerment is at any given time, or how women experience empowerment. And it's the latter that I've tried to capture. In what ways did which women experience empowerment, of what types, through their participation in Hindu nationalist politics in different time periods? And that, of course, is a much harder and denser question to try to answer. It's also why I conceive of the book and its argument and its methods as being more interpretive in approach.
Yeah, thank you. And I mean, it reminded me of many of the conversations that we have had where the idea of like, empowerment as a dichotomous variable also assumes, like you just said, women as a fixed category, but also women's interests as dichotomous in nature or fixed in nature, wherein you identify pre facto, these are women's interests by definition. And therefore, either those interests are aligning or not aligning with a particular movement. And therefore, we come with like a presumption of why something might or might not be empowering for women. So this is really helpful as a setup for that.
Yes, I think that's right.
So now in the same chapter, you cite a series of incidents between 1985 to 1992 that expose some of the tensions between so-called women's issues and the feminist movement at the time. Could you guide the audience through these tensions and how they fed into the Hindu nationalist strategy of mobilization in this period?
Yes, I will. This will be one of my longer answers, as you'll see. So the three main incidents I examine in chapter two are the cases of Shah Bano and Muslim personal law, Roop Ganwar and Sati, and the destruction of the Babri Masjid at Ayodhya. Each of these cases or controversies has been very well studied, especially by feminist scholars. But in this book, I re-examined them, sort of reinterpreted them in a particular way to try to unravel how each of them provides an example of the multiple ways that the BJP deployed what I call a strategy of gendered mobilization. So let me start with the first case. Again, just a brief look at each of these. The case of Shah Bano was a controversy over whether Muslim personal law as practiced in India superseded the right of a woman to maintenance or alimony support after a divorce in order to prevent destitution. And the key to this case was the way, in terms of my analysis, was the way the BJP deployed gendered discourses. They argued for the reform and even elimination of Muslim religious laws in India as a way to enhance in Indian Muslim women's legal rights. But their position was widely seen and understood as, and I quote here from the book, quote, an anti-minority and especially anti-Muslim stance cloaked under the rhetoric of women's rights, close quote. And so in making this kind of argument, the BJP, I argue, changed the language around the issue of the personal laws entirely and actually wrested or seized sort of discursive control of the issue from Indian feminists and other progressive organizations who had actually long advocated for the reform of religious laws. So this was the tactic or approach of deploying gendered discourses. As I call it. Now, the second case of Roop Kanwar and Sati in 1987 illustrated another piece of this strategy, which was for the BJP and Hindu nationalists to challenge the claims of feminists to define or represent what women's rights actually were, or what women's issues are, as you mentioned above, who gets to define what women's issues are. And they sort of hung the second piece of the strategy that hung the hat on that hook. In response to a highly controversial case of a 19-year-old newlywed woman who burned to death on the funeral pyre of her husband, Hindu nationalist women at the state level in the state of Rajasthan, where this happened, rallied into the streets to argue that when voluntary, the act, when it's done voluntarily, the act of committing sati was a widow's right, that it was a woman's right to commit sati when she did so voluntarily, that feminists and others had no business or standing to get in the way of. And quoting again here from the book, the way I summarize it is as follows. The Hindu rights challenge to feminist and anti-sati activism took both physical and discursive forms. Feminists and Hindu nationalist women came face to face with each other in the streets, yelling at and jostling each other. Many feminist activists expressed shock at encountering this rebuke from the very women whose rights they believed themselves to be fighting for and defending. So again, the idea of challenging feminists to be able to say, like, well, you say women's rights are this, but we say a woman's right is this. That was the second case and the second prong of this gendered mobilization strategy that I argue the BJP deployed in the 1980s. And then finally, the third case that I look at is the destruction of the mosque at Ayodhya in 1992, which is, of course, has just in the last few months been spectacularly resolved in a certain type of way. And I mean, I'm saying spectacularly with air quotes, in a very public spectacle kind of way. But that's not our question here. So the case that I look at in 1982, at that stage, illustrated how Hindu nationalists, which is when the mosque was destroyed, illustrated how Hindu nationalists rallied women into the streets. And again, this happened in each of three cases. Each of these cases illustrated a different, they all manifested all these aspects, deploying gender discourses, rallying women into the streets, challenging feminism. But I argue that each case showed one of the three prongs very prominently. And this third case, the prong that was most prominent was rallying women into the streets. So I demonstrate how women came out for the national procession in 1990 that the BJP led, what was called the Rath Yatra, throughout central and northern India. Women were also present at the actual destruction of the mosque as it was happening, though there is no evidence that women physically climbed onto the mosque or participated physically in the destruction of the mosque. There was a wonderful quote I found in one source that was describing the events of the day, who, you know, there was some discussion about like women in their saris, it would be awkward for them to climb onto a mosque with pickaxes and chisels and hammers. But women were very much present at the destruction. After the mosque came down, communal violence, which spread throughout India. And here, militant, again, I'm quoting from the book, militant Hindu nationalist women's active participation in the bloodletting was well documented. So they were participating before, during, and after in this case. So in each of these three cases separately and taken as a whole, I find that the BJP deployed gendered discourses, rallied women into the streets, and challenged feminism at each juncture. They brought themselves or put themselves even into conflict with Indian feminist views, positions, and analysis of women's rights and women's issues.
Thank you for that explanation. And like, as in a question I have based on that is also, to what degree isn't so this broader process of gender-based mobilization that you identify in this period, to what degree do you think there was a proactive stance that the BJP at that time emerging as a relatively national party for the first time, having mm-hmm. split off and reformed after the Janata Dal, took as in like it viewed its electoral prospects and realized this idea of like women are an important body, we need to look at women's interests, so therefore a more proactive response of engaging with these issues versus to some degree a more reactive response that these issues are happening as they are and how do we frame our responses to these issues, assuming it has one or the other, because if I had to wager a guess, you'll probably say somewhere in the middle.
You know that I'll say both.
Because there's also the periods and the other events like Meenakshi Puram, where questions of religion were also becoming very prominent for the BJP. So how would you view this period then?
I think that's a really good question. And it's one that one could grapple with one of the subsequent questions also thinks about this, the sort of intentionality, how much of this is right sort of intentional action. And I you are right, and you know me well enough to know that I am going to say it's both proactive and reactive, but I think both the pieces of proactivity and reactivity, if I can, come from the incentive structures that I think most things can be answered by. So this is literally a political party that is going to succeed. They understand that they have to get women's votes. And if that's in tension with certain aspects of ideology, it's just going to be about how to navigate, maybe a nice word for it, paper over or cover over those tensions might be a different way to put it. But it does make those incentive structures, to my mind, and this is a core fundamental assumption of the book, make the BJP unique amongst other Hindu nationalist organizations. Like the RSS does not have to win votes to stay in power. So they may have different approaches to these things. In terms of the question of how proactively are they thinking about, so do we have, you know, is there a council of BJP leaders somewhere sitting in saying we have to mobilize women because that's the way to do it? I'm not sure that that's the case, but at that level, and I don't think they're saying, I think something like a gendered mobilization strategy, I don't believe there was a council of BJP leaders saying we're going to have a gendered mobilization strategy. It's going to have three prongs. One prong is going to be to challenge them. The way I've analyzed it is an analysis looking back at what I believe happened. I don't think that means in that precise way that they planned it out. But I don't think that means that it wasn't intentional, that it wasn't proactive, that it wasn't, that there was, because of the incentive structures, an understanding that excluding women or marginalizing women in the way that was perhaps done in the early 20th century didn't work then. It's not going to work now. And so in that sense, I think there was a proactive thinking about it. So the answer, I would say, does fall somewhere in between, in my view.
Thank you. And now going back into that period you just referred to, as your title alludes, you label the first period of Hindu nationalist movement as marginalizing women from political participation. What are some of the reasons that explain this position in that period?
So this is a very good question, and I'm not sure my research led me to an answer that satisfied me 100% or that sort of put a lot an end to the question, so to speak. So in the early 20th century, the original political party of Hindu nationalism was, of course, the Hindu Mahasabha. And I think part of the answer to why that organization marginalized women lies in some inherent characteristics of the party or organization itself, which I do delve into in the book in some detail. Parts of a couple of chapters deal with this. So for one thing, the Mahasabha, and maybe the first thing with that the Mahasabha was never solely a political party. So if the rest of my argument is about the unique incentive structure that political parties sit in, then it's fair to say that the Hindu Mahasabha was not only a political party, it was also an organization. And it started as a you know, literal translation of something like Great Assembly or Great Association of and for Hindus. It emerged actually in response to the formation of the Muslim League in Eastern India in 1906. And initially, the Mahasabha wasn't even a standalone organization, let alone a political party, but it served as sort of a pressure group or an interest group of sorts within the Congress party. And it wasn't until 1937, it was 30 years after it was founded, after the Mahasabha was founded, that it split with the Congress party and then struck out as an independent organization. And at that time, it started dabbling in elections. So it was always sort of a political party sitting alongside a different kind of organization. But it suffered always from poor leadership, especially, and here I want to emphasize in terms of what a political party should be doing if it wanted to win elections. Some people might come, I'm not saying that their social mobilizations didn't efforts failed or did not set a foundation for what was to come later, though we could have that discussion as well. But I'm focusing particularly as a political party, right? They did not have leadership that could resolve sort of internal contradictions within the party, such as, here again, quoting from the book, quote, the fundamental tension between a Western egalitarian conception of the nation and hierarchical and inegalitarian aspects of Brahmanical culture. Or the conflict between internal factions within the Mahasabha that wanted to reform Hinduism versus other factions that wanted to retrench into its orthodoxies. And as I argue in the book, again, quote, the Mahasabha and its leaders in hindsight turned out to be on the wrong side of history on multiple issues. They rejected Gandhian nonviolence. They were often perceived as being pro-British. They refused to accept partition, even as it became inevitable. Much of their leadership was drawn from princely classes that were reliant on British support for their survival and more likely to be threatened by an independence movement than supportive of one. And so for all these many types of reasons, I argue in the book that in retrospect, these sort of overwhelming failures of the Mahasabha as a political party seem almost overdetermined. I mean, there's almost too many reasons why it failed as a political party. But then I also argue that excluding or marginalizing women politically was part and parcel of this package of reasons that the Mahasabha did fail as a political party. But so then why did they exclude or marginalize women? As we know, it can be difficult to explain a non-event or explain why something didn't happen. Yet I try in the book to go through a logic exercise of sorts. Did they exclude women because in that time period, the early 20th century, women were largely excluded from politics in India anyway? But that argument doesn't work, as I show, because in that time period, and even well before that, the Congress Party had found ways to bring women into their activities and leadership structures. But so then did the Mahasabha exclude women because of the religious underpinnings of their ideology? I mean, the Congress Party was secular and sort of center-left, so maybe that's why. The religion, the underpinnings of their ideology and their status as a religious nationalist political party is what led the Mahasabha to marginalize women, maybe to an extent. But then I turn to the example of the Muslim League and find multiple examples of their mobilization of women in the early 20th century. So then maybe it's just something about Hindu nationalism that doesn't, right, that sort of marginalizes women. But there, here again, I bring in the example of the RSS, which was founded in 1925, stands today as the anchor organization of Hindu nationalism. And within 11 years of their founding, by 1936, they had an active women's wing, the Rashtra Sevika Samiti. So each of these steps along the way doesn't seem to be the answer to why the Hindu Mahasabha wouldn't have or would have marginalized women. Other religious nationalist parties were doing it. Other political parties, secular parties were doing it. Even other Hindu nationalist organizations were doing it. Now, I want to just hasten to add here that it's not part of my argument that these other organizations I've talked about were model examples of the genuine exclusion of women. That's not what I'm saying. Even if we believe and argue that these other organizations only managed to include women in token ways, my point is rather that the Hindu Mahasabha didn't even manage to find token ways to include women. Like, they didn't even reach that point. And we're still left with the question of why not. In the end, I would probably argue that it comes, that I think the best answer is probably their ideological underpinnings. And I quote some of their leaders from that time period who argue that the woman is the flower of the home, this kind of thing. And that itself sits in what I believe to be, after studying this, you know, this organization quite a bit, even in some of my other publications, what I see is sort of a failure to grapple with the meaning and the reality of impending democracy. And ultimately, we could just call it even a failure of vision, that of, you know, vision that could look forward and outward instead of inward and backward. And again, these are also the things that then contribute to the party's failure as a political party itself.
Yeah. Thank you for that fantastic overview. And that really does put in context some of the other changes in the 1980s that we just discussed and the context therein. All right. Now, I mean, at the end of chapter three, you have a note that I wanted to discuss, which is titled Analyzing Positionality and Leveraging Liminality. Mm-hmm. How do you think your positionality influenced and shaped your research?
So this is a question that I really tried to grapple with in the book. And rather than having what might come across as somewhat rote or standard sort of statement of my positionality, which just lists out a bunch of my demographic characteristics, I really tried very hard to assess and analyze which aspects of my positionality in different time periods actually affected the research as I was able to do it. Ultimately, I think that my status as both insider and outsider, so as someone who was born in India, still retains strong cultural and familial ties, but who grew up and was educated and works in the US and presents culturally as American, these insider-outsider aspects gave me some forms of access while withholding others. And I go through in that part of the book what I think those are. I walk the reader through specific examples related to language, related to dress, as well as caste affiliations and assumptions, to demonstrate where I think some of these aspects, again, came in, where they enabled access, where they might have posed barriers, where they led people to talk to me in a certain way instead of another way, et cetera. Then the other important point with this that I wanted to make and to emphasize seems sort of obvious on its face, but I think it's not always analyzed as such in our research. And that is that the positionality of the researcher, positionality is not a static thing even for the researcher, but changes over time. Again, it seems so obvious, but I don't know if we always analyze it in a dynamic way. And the context in which we work also change, so that one's positionality is changing, the context is changing, everything is changing all the time, everywhere. And I have actually published a separate piece in an edited volume on gender and Hindu nationalism, which was edited by Amrita Basu and Thanika Sarkar, in which I specifically go through the differences between, for me, studying the BJP in the early 1990s, as I did for my dissertation research and my first book, and then going back specifically in the 2010s to study women in the BJP as a particular topic. And so I analyze both how I had changed and how the context had changed and how those two changes interacted with each other. My main conclusion there was that as the party between the two periods had grown and become much more institutionalized in the later period than the earlier one, so that we, in some ways, party leaders seemed more accessible, but in actual practice, they had probably become less accessible. And this was reinforced by the changes in my own positionality from, you know, was at the time sort of young unmarried graduate student from a very prestigious and globally known university. And then in the earlier period to being, you know, an older, married, more established professor in the later period, and how people perceived me differently and approached me differently in those ways. So it's very, the answer is it's very complicated.
No, but again, it's
very important to think about.
Absolutely. Yeah. And that's something that I think about in my own work. And I think increasingly people are paying attention to moving beyond just like statements of positionality versus actually interrogating positionality.
Yeah. I like that way of putting it. That's right.
Thank you. Now, moving on to the current period, in the book, you argue that the Hindu right has begun to incorporate women as it nurtures an ideology of gender complementarity. Could you explain how this shift has come about and how it relates to this ideology of gender complementarity?
Yeah, so first we would establish the definition of gender complementarity as being a gender ideology that sort of argues or holds or assumes that men and women are equal, but just have different roles to play in society. And as one party leader put it, quote, you know, society could be imagined like a chickpea or a chana, and men and women were like the two halves of that whole. So you need both halves to make up the whole. Both halves are equally important to making up the whole, but they're not the same thing. They both play different roles. And this idea was echoed by almost all the party leaders I interviewed, again, men and women alike, in this contemporary period, the 2013 to 2016 period, is the periodization in the book. So through my research, I concluded on the contemporary period, I concluded that this conception of gender complementarity was a critical underpinning to the idea of incorporation, right, as the thing that was happening in the contemporary period, which is to say that the conception of gender complementarity shaped how the party brought women in. It shaped incorporation. I mean, it was the underpinning idea of it. So the BJP's incorporation of women in the contemporary period, I would say, follows and reflects the idea that men and women are equally important to the party and its success, but they don't necessarily play the same roles in the party. And just as feminists critique the idea of gender complementarity as meaning in practice that women actually have less power and voice than men. So this is sort of a feminist critique of gender complementarity. I think a similar kind of question could be raised about, right, the BJP's incorporation of women in the contemporary period. I do some analysis in the book of, you know, in the run up to the 2014 election, so the 2013-2014 campaign, women were especially prominent as party official spokespersons, right? Official press and media spokespersons for the party, and so I, you know, go through an analysis of what that means. So you're clearly speaking for the party, right? But are you in the rooms where the policies that you're advocating were formulated, and they may or may not be, but those are not the same thing, I argue. So that's sort of one small example of this, you know, the roles that women are playing in the party, and what those roles were. In practice and through the research, I wasn't convinced that women in the BJP do not have less power and voice than women. I said it as a double negative. And here again, I do some analysis of, you know, what are the committees within the party that have the real power in setting policy, and how many women did those include, and how were women brought into different party structures. So I do all that analysis in the book. So again, I trace this empirically by looking at women's roles in the party's governance structures, the women's wing as candidates, and also looking at women's issues in party platforms. And my ultimate conclusion is that the move from marginalization with the Hindu Mahasabha to mobilization and incorporation with the BJP, that movement over time does represent important progress, which cannot and should not be dismissed. I think it's really very important to say that and not overlook it. And it can also be true, because in women's studies, we think about both and thinking at the same time, even as the gender ideologies of Hindu nationalism have evolved to look different over time, across eras, those ideologies do continue, in my argument, to tether women to their societal roles in the home and family. Under the contemporary BJP, that tethering is, I argue, it's more conceptual, but it still continues. Under the Mahasabha, it was almost a literal tethering, like women should stay in the home physically. But even under the contemporary BJP, continues to rely on the idea that to be involved in party politics, women need, quote, family support. And this is a concept I unpack extensively in the book. It's the one thing that, without prompting, every single interviewee I had brought up the concept of family support. And that without family support, women's participation in Hindu nationalist politics, or even in the public sphere in general, risks breaking up families and family ties and ultimately society itself, right? So that linking of women to their social roles in the family and the home is still there, even in the contemporary period. So yeah, that's what I would say about gender complementarity.
Thank you. And that analysis reminds me of, like, I mean, Tarini Bedi's work as well in Matronage and how women of Shiv Sena navigate that kind of tension between these ideas.
Yeah.
And alluding to something you spoke of earlier and, like, which is relevant to this analysis, is this difference between, like you said, incorporation versus inclusion, wherein inclusion, mm-hmm. Incorporation goes beyond mobilization, but it still stops short of being inclusive as such. What do you think? How do you see those differences, and where do you think the gap lies between moving from incorporation to inclusion?
Yeah, I mean, I think it lies in exactly those places that might be the similar places of saying, how do we get past what we might see as the limitations of gender complementarity as an ideology? In other words, that to say men and women are equal, but, you know, I'd say, why do we need the but? Can we get rid of the but and just say men and women are equal? That perhaps that might be how one moves from incorporation to inclusion. So I'm just sort of thinking about this as we talk, but that I think it's that but at the end of the gender complementarity that becomes the thing in my mind that stops one from, right, that differentiates incorporation from perhaps inclusion.
All right. Thank you. The last question, and I mean, while academics are understandably hesitant to make predictions, in the coming months, India faces a seismic general election where the political appeal of women's support is evident by the nature of campaigning and women-centric policies being put forth by various parties, be it the BJP at the national level or a number of state parties. How do you see the future of Hindu nationalist political mobilization of women? And where do you think the spaces for counter-mobilization may lie, if at all?
So this is the million-dollar question, or maybe the million-rupee question in this case, I think, which you have very wisely saved for last. You know, one question is, like, the future of the role of women in the BJP. I mean, will they get to inclusion? I mean, maybe that's one possible future, which is interesting to think about. At the moment, not just in India, but globally, I think the prospects for successful counter-mobilization to the kinds of political forces that we're seeing, again, around the world, in some ways, you know, India was ahead of the curve. Maybe that's something to be proud of. Maybe it's not. We can think about it. But the sorts of political movements and forces that we're seeing around the globe, right now, it looks and feels like again, the prospects for successful counter-mobilization feel thin, right? They feel slim. And yet I remain committed to the idea that I gesture to at the end of the book, which is that if, as I believe to be the case, the BJP's success lies to a significant extent in its ability to mobilize the electoral support of women, of groups like women and lower castes and Dalits. And here I'm talking about their success, not solely electorally, but sort of more broadly societally, as you look at in much of your research. But that if the BJP rose to prominence on the shoulders of these groups that they had previously marginalized, then I believe, or maybe I want to believe, that the nascent roots for counter-mobilization will lie there as well. The BJP could not be and never was a mass political party without an expanded base of support, right? By definition, for much of the early parts of its existence, it was a party with a fairly narrow base of support. They've expanded that base of support through bringing in, mobilizing, incorporating different groups, of which, you know, again, I use gender and women as the lens for that kind of process. And so if and when those, and under what conditions, those expanded communities serving as bases of support withdraw their support, right, I believe that could be the turning point. And we perhaps saw some early hint of what this might look like with the Shaheen Bagh protests, again, which you, of course, have researched and written about. And so this struck me, and is it a prediction or is it aspirational? I don't know the answer to that question, but this struck me as the type and nature of movement that could finally reverse the tide and begin to lead to change.
Thank you. And I mean, as much as for my own personal pessimism, some of the reactions we're seeing from the BJP, some of the ways in which they're going out of line to cull the opposition, do other kinds of things, is reflective of maybe there's an undercurrent of dissent and protest that might materialize, hopefully, in some kind of response.
That's right. I think that's right. There's an awareness of threat, one might put it, and that suggests the presence of some kind of threat. If you're reacting to something, maybe there's something there to react to. Yeah.
Anyhow, thank you for that response. This concludes our conversation. Thank you so much for taking out the time to talk to me. I'm really excited for the audience to discover the book and your work and learn from it the same as I have. Thank you.
Absolutely. Thank you so much.